Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Elizabeth Jernigan, Barbara Pinolini, Kimberly Gilbert, Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, Eric Messner, Karen Novak, MJ Casey, Dan Stevens, Michael Glenn, Christopher Sheeran, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Ted Stoddard, Ken Jackson, Dylan Lynch, Mort Shelby, Nathaniel Perry, Greg Reinfeld, and Johann Detweiler. Deathlands number 89, Time Castaways. Creature exploded out of the laurel bushes and charged across the dirt road, its four arms raised for a fast kill, the black talons dripping green venom. Set Chief Charles Donovan flicked off the safety on his massive crossbow.
It's an ambush! Jane and Rosemary, stay with the cart! Everybody else form a firing line!
The set man holding the reins in the buckboard wagon tried to control the frightened team of horses while his partner lifted a balanced pair of throwing axes into view. Meanwhile, the rest of the platoon brandished their crossbows and formed a defensive line between the charging monster and the Imperial treasure cart. Assuming a marksman stance, Donovan aimed his heavy crossbow and fired. A split second later, the other set men did the same with their smaller version, unleashing a maelstrom of wooden shafts. Bristling with arrows, the creature recoiled from the staggering impacts, but the heavy wooden slats covering the giant man underneath were not penetrated. The armored man shook his two arms in rage, the fake arms suspended underneath them, duplicating the motion precisely. Then a second armored man came out of the bushes, closely followed by two more.
Keep firing!
Donovan reached over a shoulder to pull a stone quarrel from the quiver on his back. At the sight of the additional cold hearts, the Anchorville Suckman needed no prompting to work the levers on their complex crossbows, the wooden machinery automatically drawing back the bowstring and feeding another half-size arrow into the firing notch from the box magazine mounted on top. They fired in unison, and one of the attackers dropped to a knee, blood pouring from a small gap between his leg and belly. Stepping protectively in front of their wounded brother, the other cold hearts made a coughing noise inside their misshapen head masks, and in response, something flashed across the dirt road too fast to be seen clearly. Dropping their weapons, two of the sect men staggered forward. They raked fingernails along their throats, desperately clawing at the tiny feathered darts buried in their skin. Already their flesh was turning a bilious green, and flecks of foam began to appear on their deathly pale lips. Pausing only for a moment, Donovan mercifully shot an arrow through the head of the nearest wounded Setman, while the rest of the platoon did the same for the second man. There was no antidote for Kraken poison. Reloading quickly, the Setman fired again, wounding another of what they called hillies. Retreating slightly, the Coldhearts fired again. But ready this time, the Sekmen managed to dodge the incoming darts successfully. However, that was when Donovan suddenly noticed a dozen figures moving among the trees edging the road. The bastards had to have brought along the whole tribe for this attack. Donovan had no idea how they knew about the cargo in the treasure wag, but there was no way he was going to let his baron's prize fall into the dirty hands of these stinking inbreed throwbacks. Tossing aside his loaded crossbow, Donovan clawed open the sealed holster at his side and hauled a pre-dark gun into view. Lovingly polished every day, the revolver shone rainbow bright with the reflected lights of the Aurora Borealis filling the sky. Donovan slid a single brass round into the revolver and closed the cylinder with a jerk of his wrist.
Achmed, Hannigan, watch the trees! Everybody else, flanking position!
Launching another volley, the Sekmen hastily reloaded and quickly formed a wing formation behind their chief. Coughing out more darts, the hillies charged, concentrating on a young Sekhmet struggling to clear an arrow jammed in the loading mechanism of his crossbow. Hastily taking aim, Donovan fired. The hillie stopped running, blood pouring from the mouth of his carved wooden mask. But even as the dying Coldheart sank to his knees, the rest of the hillies converged on the teenager, the bare talons on their forearms raking the youth, slicing him open and ripping out bloody gouts of flesh. The Sekhmet went backward, his uniform slashed apart and soaked with blood. Without hesitation, the Sekhmet killed their friend. Then savagely hammered the hated mountain men with flight after flight of half arrows, focusing on the narrow opening of the mouth in their grotesque masks. Waving their double set of arms as a distraction did nothing this time, and two of the hillies slowed, red fluids trickling out of their wooden collars. Unexpectedly, a boomerang flashed over the Sekhmet to brutally hit the mask of an undamaged hillie. The deadly weapon did no damage to the stout oak armor, but the attack distracted the Coldhearts for a moment, just enough time for Donovan to finish unleashing a second bullet. The Sec Chief carefully took out the knee of the hilly, gore and splinters spraying into the trees. At the sight, the lead hilly paused for a long moment, yanked something from around his waist, and threw it down hard. Instantly, there was an explosion of dark smoke, the roiling cloud rapidly swelling to fill the road for yards. Quickly backing away from the mysterious fumes, the anchor Sekhmet shot half arrows blindly into the smoke, but there were no answering sounds of a hit. Only the sound of the hillies heading away down the roadway toward the nearby shore. With a start, Donovan realized that the mountain men had to be trying to reach a boat, which could only mean reinforcements, more weapons, or worse, escape.
Fuck that!
Pulling in a deep breath, Donovan charged into the fumes, braced for a wave of searing pain. But nothing occurred, and when he finally had to breathe, there was only a sweet smell of flowers and kelp. It was just smoke, not poison.
Stay with the wag! These glebes are mine!
But sir...
This could be a diversion! Stay with the wag!
Donovan pulled out an obsidian axe. Zigzagging through the smoke, the Sec Chief ran as fast as he could, and as the fumes began to thin, there were the hillies, both brandishing axes, and coming his way. Another damn trap. Diving forward, Donovan rolled under the swing of the double blades and came up standing behind the Coldhearts. Shoving his gun against the neck of the closest one, he fired. And the wooden helmet was blown off the man's head, his face exploding outward. As the last hillie spun around, Donovan saw that it was their leader, the elaborate designs on the armor proclaiming his exalted rank. The two men locked gazes for a full heartbeat, each testing for any sign of fear. Then they swung their war axes in unison, and each axe shattered, razor-sharp shards of green volcanic glass flying everywhere. Donovan backed away, while the hilly pulled out a granite knife, the feathered edge gleaming bright as steel. Swinging up his gun, Donovan expertly met the thrust, and stone bounced off metal.
Should have stayed with your veal, boy!
The Sec Chief slammed the wooden shaft of the broken axe against the side of the hilly's head. The wooden helmet shifted slightly, covering the Coldheart's eyes. The hilly pulled back, one gloved hand fumbling with his helmet, while the other waved the granite blade around wildly. Purely by chance, the blade scored a bloody slash across Donovan's chest. Then Donovan changed targets, and with his axe handle started battering at the arm holding the blade. The hilly clawed for a lumpy globe hanging from around his waist, but Donovan smacked the hand aside and went on hammering the hilly's wooden glove. The Coldheart tried to shift the blade to his other glove, but Donovan managed to smack it away. The blade went spinning into the forest and disappeared among the bushes. The hilly dropped his gloves and grabbed the Sec Chief by the throat.
Time to die, Bill boy!
Suddenly, the world began to blur, then spin out of control, black spots swimming in Donovan's sight. When the hilly jerked and bizarrely released his grip, Donovan backed away and saw that an arrow was embedded in the hilly's helmet, blood trickling along the shaft. Massaging his sore throat, Donovan looked up just as the treasure wag rolled into view out of the smoke, every Sekhmet steadily firing flight after flight of half arrows at the hilly. A Sek woman named Rosemary was triggering Donovan's big crossbow. Snarling in rage, the hilly reached for a smoke bomb on his belt, and Rosemary fired, with a heavy shaft pinning his bare hand to the wooden armor. Then half arrow slammed into his other hand, slicing off fingers. The cold heart attempted to flee, but as he turned, a bald Sekhman threw a bolo. The stones, tied to lengths of stout rawhide, neatly spun across the intervening space, wrapped themselves tightly around the hilly's armored legs, trapping him in place. Stopping the treasure wag, the Sekhman poured onto the road and swarmed the helpless cold heart.
Pax! Pax, I surrender!
Tough.
Donovan held out an empty hand, and somebody slapped an axe into his palm. Tightening a fist around the fish-eyed grip, the Sekh chief swung the weapon with all of his might and began hacking at the hilly as if chopping down a tree. Chips flew off under the brutal impacts of a granite blade, then leather padding came into view, and finally, human skin. When he was finished, Donovan wiped the cracked blade clean on his pants and returned the borrowed weapon to the bald Sekh man.
Thanks.
Always got your back. Now we go after those others in the forest?
No. And there could be more tricks. More traps. We're heading for home. And not stopping for anything until we have a wall around our asses again. Savvy?
No need to rush, Chief. Whatever those things were in the forest, they skedaddled the minute the hilly started eating dirt.
Standing in the wagon, Rosemary rested a throwing axe on her shoulder. In spite of wearing the largest size of body armor available, her ample breasts were simply much too big and deliciously muffined over the top.
Pfft, hillies. Think they knew what we're carrying?
She glanced into the cart. Set among their piles of supplies, barrels of water and such, was a wooden strongbox bolted to the floorboards. Without explosives, it would take a day to chop into the box, and the only way to steal it was to take the whole cart. This was the best the Vill had, but what it contained was more valuable than black powder.
Shitfire, if they knew what was in that box, the bastards would have sent a dozen more cold hearts after us.
Can the chatter and go collect your arrows. The damn things don't grow on trees, you know.
The Sekhman dutifully retrieved the spent arrows, carefully pocketing the fletching and stone heads found with broken shafts. Sadly, quite a few of the half arrows were gone, lost in the forest. Reclaiming his crossbow, Donovan slung it over his shoulder, then hunted for his lost gun. He found it in the bushes undamaged, just smeared with blood and dirt. McDouglas walked up, proffering a small disfigured blob of gray metal.
Here, I got the lead back for you, Chief.
Thanks, Mac.
Donovan tucked the slug in a shirt pocket, along with the spent brass.
Excuse me, sir?
What is it, Carson?
What should we do about the dead?
The herbal smoke was almost completely gone now, and the bodies of the fallen Sekhman could be clearly seen.
We're short on time, but we'll wait. Take a shovel and bury your kin. Save their crossbows for the Baron, but you can have everything else for their kin.
You want a hand?
No thanks, Hawkman.
Carson got a shovel from the cart, then trundled off to drag a tattered corpse into the bushes and perform the odious task in private.
Those were damn scary masks. You think the bastards based it on real muties? Something from one of the outer islands? Well, those got hit a lot worse than us in the end war.
Yeah, makes sense. Unless the ocean currents have changed again. You remember when that mutie that looked like a man but was covered with suckers washed ashore from the mainland?
Oh, don't be a stoop. There ain't no mainland anymore. The whole damn world got nuked during the big heat. There's only this chain of islands, nothing more. Baron Griffin says so.
Whatever you say, cousin.
Donovan looked up at the sky before climbing into the back of the car to drape a tarpaulin over the strongbox. It didn't really need the additional protection, even if it was acid rain coming. But he felt it wise to be cautious with this cargo. A slave had found the treasure on the shore of all places and immediately turned it over to Baron Griffin. Metal. A big jagged chunk of rusty, corroded, glorious metal. Almost a full 10 pounds. None of the Sekhman had any idea what the irregular lump had once been, but soon the Vill blacksmith would convert it into a new hinge for the front gate and deadly tips for 100 war arrows. Vital protection needed by the Vill against the hairy-ass barbs in the west and that tricky bitch Wainwright to the far east. Ankerville sat smack between the two, cursed with a baron more interested in dance and song than defense. They were thankful for his wife. Lady Griffin was more of a warrior than any 10 Sekhmen in the Vill. Including him, Donovan grudgingly admitted in private. Plus, the busty woman was also a lusty sex partner. She fought like a Sekhman and fucked like a gaudy slut. Now that was a real woman. A proper ruler for any Vill. It was just bad luck that the Book of Blood had decreed she had to marry that smiling Phoebe from North Pointville.
But then, the book had to be obeyed. End of discussion. Only the throwbacks, Barbs and Hilly, screwed whomever they wished, which was why so many of them were born different. Carson returned from the bushes, shoving the wooden tool into a leather boot set alongside the cart. The sec man wordlessly assumed his position alongside the man named Gene on the front seat. Donovan sat on the treasure box and placed the loaded crossbow across his lap.
All right, mount up. Let's go home.
High overhead, the cloudy sky was alive with the multicolored radiance of the daily aurora borealis. In the distance, the thunder warned of an approaching storm. Thick fog moved over the tall stone walls of North Pointville. Torches were set at regular intervals along the wall, giving the SecMen walking patrol on the top plenty of light. And every structure inside the ville was brightly illuminated by the yellowish glow of fish oil lanterns or the cheery blaze of a fireplace. Set in the center of the log cabins, smokehouses, barracks, patched leather tents, and stone fishing shacks was a pristine field of neatly tended grass. Standing tightly packed on the field was a large crowd of civilians gathered around an old whipping post where a naked man stood, his wrists bound with rope to the crossbar of the infamous learning tree. Tiny rivulets of blood trickled down his skinny shanks, oozing steadily from the crisscross of open wounds covering his back. The tattered remains of a uniform lay on the grass around his feet. Sitting on a rosewood throne on a fieldstone dais, Baron Brenda Wainwright watched the spectacle. She disliked watching punishment details, but her presence here was necessary as the absolute ruler of the ville. She had weapons in her private arsenal, lots of them, but the sec man obeyed her commands primarily because the Baron was smart. She constantly outwitted their enemies and always found some clever new way to put food on the table, and more important, salt. Without that precious commodity, everybody in the ville would have been dead decades ago. No matter what herbs or potions the healers tried, people needed salt the way a candle needed a wick. Without it, they simply got weaker and weaker, then just stopped working entirely. Even the dead were boiled down in the smokehouse, reduced to their very essence to reclaim every single grain. Salt was life. Death was part of life as well. However, the old doomy known as Mad Pete had deemed that this particular demise was absolutely necessary to the welfare of the ville. Even then, she disliked casual killing so much that the Baron had waited patiently, and then impatiently, until some fool broke a major law and could honestly and fairly be executed. If he had been drunk on duty or stolen a lick of salt, the bastard would have been simply beaten to death and sent to the boiling pot in the smokehouse. But this one had done much worse by forcing himself upon the wife of another sec man. No matter who you were, rape was a capital offense in every ville along Royal Island. End of discussion. Her hands were clean. Well, at least on this particular death, nobody ruled a ville without knowing how to kill. She had been planning to remove her fat brother from the Oak Throne when he'd greedily eaten an unknown type of fish and died of food poisoning. As Father had always said, stupidity was its own reward. Dressed for combat on this special day, the woman was wearing a heavy blue gown cut high in the front to show off her new snakeskin boots. An ebony cascade of long hair hung loose around her stern face, artfully disguising the fact that she was missing an ear from a mutiny attack when she was a small child. A black leather bodice supported her full breasts. A wide gun belt circled her trim waist, embroidered gloves tucked into the front, a sheathed knife and holstered handgun riding at her hips. Standing by the maple throne was Sec Chief Emile LaFontaine. The hulking giant held a perfectly balanced obsidian throwing axe in a gloved hand, and there was a rifle strapped across his white back, protected from the harsh elements by a thick wolfskin sheath.
It's done, Baron.
Silence!
Sweet nuking hell! That came from the sea! The screams of the prisoner must have caught the attention of...
Slowly, a dark mountain of flesh rose from the other side of the ville wall. Six huge, inhuman eyes glaring down at the scene of torture, even as 100 tentacles began to crawl over the granite block wall.
Kraken!
A sec man on the wall fired his crossbow. Then a tentacle wrapped around his waist and the man was hauled out of view. Baron Wainwright could only stare in wonder at the mountain of flesh looming over the wall, feeding on the population. So the old Doomy had been right. The death screams of the condemned man had summoned a kraken. Then the tentacles of the monstrous creature crashed through the Vill's dockyard gate.
Defend the Vill!
By now, the Sekhmen were launching swarms of arrows into the Goliath. But if they did any damage, it was not readily apparent, and the Muti continued feeding. Meanwhile, teams of Sekhmen in the guard towers feverishly operated the hand cranks to pull back the mighty obelisks. The giant crossbows were 30 feet long and used three bows working in conjunction. Each arrow was twice the size of a man, and the barbed head was edged with thin strips of genuine Thedark steel.
Pull, you lazy bastards! Pull or die!
The team of Sekhmen loaded the arrow into the arbalest, and the catch engaged. Grabbing the aiming yoke, the burly sergeant swung the colossal weapon around toward the Muti, aimed, and yanked hard on the release lever. Then the triple bows let fly, and the giant arrow went straight into the Kraken's throat. The Muti turned toward the source of the agony, its tentacles lashing out wildly, but more giant arrows were launched from the other guard towers. The Kraken twisted madly in the deadly crossfire. A catapult snapped upward from the roof of the barracks, and a wooden barrel arched gracefully upward. It sailed over the guard towers and ignited a split second before crashing on top of the Kraken. Covered with burning alcohol, the Muti went insane, lashing its tentacles around. A flurry of crossbow arrows slammed into the beast as additional firebombs hammered the creature.
Baron!
Not yet, my friend.
More firebombs and arbalest arrows slammed into the monster, along with a score of spears, boomerangs, and a fishing harpoon that just missed going into one of the huge inhuman eyes.
Baron, we must launch the rockets!
Just a few more ticks, Sergeant.
The roof of a little shed slid aside, exposing a honeycomb of bamboo tubes. A nest of fuses dangled from the rear of each, and as the Baron watched in growing horror, a torch was touched to the group fuse, setting them aflame.
No! Too soon!
M'lady, please!
The top row of bamboo tubes unleashed a dozen homemade rockets, closely followed by the second row, then the rest. The rockets flashed upward and slammed into the Kraken, disappearing into the mottled hide, and then the first salvo detonated. Gobbets of raw flesh exploded like a geyser from the monster, sending out a ghastly spray of piss-yellow blood. The Kraken lashed out mindlessly as the second salvo of rockets detonated inside the beast. Literally torn apart from within, the monster sagged and went still, the flow of blood quickly slowing to a trickle, and then stopping entirely. At the sound of the signal bell, every man, woman, and child in the Vill stormed out of the dockyard gates, each equipped with a wicker basket and a sharp obsidian knife. Resembling an army of ants, the people crawled over the dead Muti and started to slice off pieces. Meanwhile, Sekhmen armed with axes began to hack apart the corpse.
It worked! We chilled a Kraken! What a glorious day!
You can load that into a damn crossbow and fire it. We'll get an assault from the gizzard to last the Vill for months! For years!
Plus, there's enough good leather for everyone to get new boots, belts, and winter jackets. Sinew for 1,000 crossbows. Enough bones to... well, for any damn thing we need until further notice.
Sadly, we lost the dockyard gate, a horse, and at least 12 Sekhmen.
Yes, a pity. But still a price that I would be willing to pay any time for the death of a Kraken. The bay belongs to us now. No more will our fishing boats be pulled underwater, the crew drowned, the catch destroyed.
Aye, that's the good news. Too bad we can't eat the meat. I hear it tastes fine, but... everyone who told me that was dead by nightfall.
Leave some outside the wall for the hillies to steal. Maybe we can chill two birds with one stone.
By your command, Baron. I live to serve.
Both the civvies and the Sekhmen would spend the rest of the day and most of the night dissecting the mountainous Muti, scavenging everything of value. Even the fat of the monster could be boiled down into a crude form of tallow for candles. When that odious task was accomplished, the crew of the Wendigo would haul what remained of the bedraggled corpse out into the deep water near Liar's Gate, so that the smell of the decaying corpse would scare away any other Kraken for years. Feeling exhausted and exhilarated, the Baron watched over the rest of the harvesting. The heavy bolt disengaged, and the oval portal in the rusty wall ponderously swung aside. Holding road flares and weapons, Ryan Cotter and J.B. Dick stepped through the opening and warily looked around the darkness, ready for any possible danger. The flares gave off a wellspring of light, but there was nothing in sight but some old-fashioned gym lockers attached to the riveted steel walls and a couple of plastic benches thick with dust.
Fire blast. Where the fuck are we?
Beats the hell out of me, but it doesn't resemble any redoubt I've ever seen before.
Agreed.
This room should have been the control room for the redoubt. Instead, it seemed to be inside some kind of abandoned gymnasium. Even stranger, there was a strong smell of living green plants in the dusty atmosphere, which should have been flat-out impossible. When the companions had arrived at this location, the Matrans unit promptly blew and everything had gone dark. Patiently, they'd waited for the system to automatically reboot. But when that didn't happen, they were left with no other option than to proceed deeper into the strange redoubt and hope that they could find an exit to the surface. Reaching the middle of the metal room, Ryan and JB spotted a way out of the gymnasium. A circular metal door closed with an old-fashioned wheel lock, as if it were a bank vault. However, this door was heavily encrusted with corrosion. Big flakes of rust fall into the floor like autumn leaves. It was an unnerving sight. A few moments later, Doc Tanner, Christy Roth, Jack Lauren, and Mildred Wyeth stepped from the gateway in combat formation, each of them carrying heavy backpacks, a butane cigarette lighter, and a loaded weapon.
How peculiar. Do I smell ivy?
Ivy? Sure as hell hope not.
Weird place. What is it?
My guess would be some kind of a ready room.
A ready room? Yeah, that makes sense. Some place where the pre-dark soldiers arriving via the Matrans unit could change into their uniforms.
Or out of them.
Ryan used the barrel of the Sig Sauer to open the latch on a locker. Inside the locker, Ryan found the moldy remains of what looked like civilian clothing hung neatly on hangers, sneakers on the floor, a Mets baseball cap on a small shelf, along with a small mirror and a few personal items covered with a thick layer of dust. Moving the flare closer for a better look, the Deathlands warrior then blinked at the sight of a gray plastic box on the shelf. Balancing the flare on the edge of a bench, Ryan took down the box and slid the plastic lock to the side. The lid came free to expose a spotlessly clean .44 caliber Ruger revolver, along with a cardboard box of ammunition. There was a brass brush for cleaning the cylinders, and even a small plastic bottle of homogenized gun oil. The box was nearly full of regulation U.S. Army combat cartridges, semi-jacketed hollow points, as deadly as brass came, and the ammo was in perfect condition. Ryan could not believe his luck. 34 live rounds.
Ready room my ass. This is a ward room.
JB went to the next locker and pushed open the corroded door. Hanging inside was more decaying clothing, a three-piece suit this time, covered with tiny mushrooms. Checking a locker in another row, Mildred discovered the sad remains of a flower print dress, along with a matching half jacket and scarf. However, hanging behind the rotting strips of cloth was a small shoulder holster containing a slim Beretta Bell. Gingerly extracting the pistol, Mildred saw that it was only streaked with surface corrosion. The Beretta could probably be salvaged with a thorough cleaning. Dropping the clip, Mildred found it fully loaded with oily cartridges that looked in fairly decent condition. Those weren't standard lead bullets, but black talons, armor-piercing rounds. Extremely illegal for anybody in her day to carry, except for special government agents. Returning it to the holster, Mildred rummaged about and located a tiny decorative purse. She found only a plastic-coated driver's license, some folded bills now thick with gray fuzz, an expired credit card, a lump of crud that might once have been some candy breath mints, and a folded leather wallet. Opening the wallet carefully, Mildred saw a faded picture of the owner, a slim blonde with a laminated government-issue identification card bearing the Great Seal of the United States and the embossed seal of the United States Navy Special Operations.
Well, I'll be damned. This woman was Navy intelligence.
A sec man?
An extremely good sec person.
Indeed, madam. But more important, if she was a member of the United States Navy, then mayhap we are currently on a ship of some kind.
A ship? Well, that would explain the riveted walls and floors.
Don't fear waves. We're not drifting at sea. Maybe in dock?
Not necessarily. If this is a ship, it would have to be enormous to hold a Matrans unit. Anything that huge, and we'd never feel the waves unless trapped in the middle of a hurricane. But maybe not even then.
An aircraft carrier was certainly large enough to carry a Matrans unit. The vessels were often called ocean-going cities, they were so huge. A carrier held 100 jet fighters and a crew of over 1,000. More important, they were powered by nuclear reactors.
Buried alive.
I consider that highly unlikely, my friend. Plants need sunshine to live, even that accursed mutant ivy. So whatever type of vessel this is, there must be a breach in the hull, and thus direct egress to the outside world.
Sounds reasonable. But the sooner we see daylight, the better.
Agreed. But we're not leaving all of this live brass behind. Everybody grab a partner and do a fast wreck of the lockers. Take only the brass. Leave the blasters behind for a scav later.
Nodding their agreement, the companions got busy. Moving steadily through the array of lockers, they soon amassed a staggering collection of clips, magazines, speed loaders, and loose brass in a wide assortment of calibers, along with a couple of guns in reasonably good condition. Naturally, there had not been anything usable for Doc's Black Powder Lama amid the civilian arsenal, but the scholar had discovered a .44 Ruger revolver, a sturdy weapon of devastating power, along with a full box of 50 hollow-point Magnum cartridges. Doc slipped the Ruger into one of his deep empty pockets. Finished with their scavenging, the companions, assuming a combat formation, approached the circular door, the locking wheel situated in the middle. Ryan illuminated the door with a road flare and saw that it was firmly locked. But rust had eaten away the metal along the edge of the jamb, and there was a definite breeze blowing into the ready room, carrying a faint trace of plant life and something else. Pointing at the others, Ryan directed them to flanking positions on either side of the door, while JB knelt on the floor and checked for traps. Angling his flare to give his friend some light, Ryan watched the man run fingertips along the rough surface of the door. Then he pressed an ear to the metal to try to detect any mechanical movements, and finally passed a compass along the material to check for any magnetic sensors or proximity triggers. After a few moments, the armorer tucked the compass away and smiled.
Yeah, it's clean. At least as far as I can tell.
Holstering his Sig Sauer, Ryan passed the flare to JB and exchanged positions with the man. Taking hold of the locking wheel, Ryan turned the handle. As the bolts disengaged, he started to walk backward, slowly hauling the door open against the protesting hinges. As the thick door cleared the jam, JB squinted into the darkness on the other side.
Okay, looks clear. Son of a bitch!
And a bright muzzle flash, something large was briefly seen in the outside corridor. Then a metal arm extended through the doorway, and mechanical pincers brushed aside the shotgun to close around JB's throat. As the robotic arm started dragging the struggling JB out of the ready room, the companion saw a hulking machine of some kind filling the outside corridor. There was a domed head and a cylindrical body with treads on the bottom like an army tank. More important, the machine possessed six arms, each of them brandishing spinning buzzsaws, pincers, or pneumatic hammers. It was clearly built to ruthlessly terminate invaders. Doc assumed a firing stance and grimly triggered the Lama. The huge .44 caliber mini-ball of the Civil War hand cannon slammed into the joint of the pincers, cracking the seal, and amber hydraulic fluid gushed out. As the pressure dropped, JB forced the pincers apart and wriggled free to drop flat and get out of the way of the others. Now unencumbered by the presence of their friend, the rest of the companions cut loose with a fusillade, hammering the big machine. Scrambling to his feet, JB swung around the Uzi and raked the droid with 9mm Parabellum rounds. Aiming for the silvery dome on top, Ryan popped several 9mm rounds into the shiny head of the machine. The hollow point rounds ricocheted off the material, but the dome bent, and the droid began to wildly jerk, the metal arms flailing uncontrollably. Focusing all of their weapons on the head, the companions mercilessly hammered the droid until it began to turn randomly, the armor treads going in different directions. Suddenly, smoke began to rise from the joints. Fat electrical sparks crawled over the machine, and then it went stock still. The machinery rapidly building in power. As JB hurried back into the room, Ryan and Christy both rushed for the door, and together slammed it shut. Ryan gingerly probed the wheel to find it extremely warm, but not too hot to touch. He boldly cracked open the circular door once more and looked outside. There was a smoky dent in the steel corridor, the walls bulging outward slightly. However, there was no sign of the droid, only a scattering of partially melted machine parts littering the floor. Ryan pulled out his last flare and scraped it across the rough wall until the tip sparked. The flare gushed into smoky flame.
What a piece of shit. A sick droid would have been much tougher to chill.
True enough, but we better stay on triple red. If this thing had caught us in the open, we'd have bought the farm for sure.
I just hope this is some sort of a redoubt and not a pre-dark warship. Those were actually designed to be a maze of corridors, ladders, and passageways to confuse any potential invaders.
Quite so, dear lady. There is little chance of us successfully finding the egress in an unfamiliar locale through pitch darkness.
Finding what?
The exit.
Gotcha.
Well, we wouldn't be in absolute darkness. Not quite, anyway.
Rummaging in her med kit, Mildred came up with a battered flashlight and pumped the handle of the survivalist tool until the batteries were recharged. Then she pressed the switch. A weak beam issued from the ancient device, and she played it around the war-torn corridor, making sure that there were no still-functioning pieces of the war machine. With his Sig Sauer at the ready, Ryan eased into the corridor. Past the blast zone, the metal corridor was covered with pale filaments that he soon recognized as roots. They covered the ceiling and hung thick on the walls, extending out of sight in either direction. Scowling, he glanced at the wall opposite the ready room. In every redoubt, that was always the location of a wall map showing new personnel where everything was to be found. The lack of a map, or any sign that a map had once been there, was proof positive to him that this was not a redoubt. Ryan looked in one direction, then the other. Both went on for 100 paces to end at an intersection with a ladder.
Okay. Anybody got an idea which way we should try?
Left.
Now, how do you know that?
Roots thinner it to the right, thicker to the left. So, that way out.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
You do know that Holmes never actually said that, don't you? Not in the books, anyway. Only the movies.
I am literate, madam.
Ignoring the banter, the companion sidled carefully around the blast crater, and Ryan took the lead, heading to the left. Spying some lumps on the floor up ahead, Ryan slowed his advance, but soon saw that they were only a couple of crumbling skeletons covered with roots, the tendrils entwined among the loose bones and moldy strips of clothing. A gold ring glistened on the finger bones of a hand no longer attached to anything, and silver dots shone from the loose teeth inside a lopsided skull. Mildred leaned down to inspect the plastic ID badge still pinned to a piece of uniform lying on a skeleton.
This might tell us something. It seems that we are inside a U.S. Navy ship after all. The USS Grover Harrington.
Indeed. And who was that, madam? Some politician, perhaps?
Never heard of the guy. He must have been an admiral.
I don't care about the name. What type of water wag is it?
Sorry. Again, I have no idea. This could be anything from an aircraft carrier to a missile frigate.
Well, at least we know it's a boat. Which means up is the way out.
Reaching the intersection, Ryan paused at the sight of a wide breach on the metal floor. The hole didn't appear to have been caused by an explosion, as the edges were feathered with corrosion, not bent and twisted from the force of a detonation. That was when Ryan noticed the slow drip of water from above. A split second later, a drop plummeted past him, directly through the hole, and into the darkness below. Kneeling slightly, Ryan lowered the flare into the darkness and froze at the sight of another droid, apparently the same model as the one they had just taken out. However, this one was in even worse shape, the dome already cracked, several of the rusty arms lying on the deck nearby, and a broken tread was hanging limply off the gears.
Not much of a danger there.
Not unless we trip over it.
What are those boxes behind it?
The weak beam did little to alleviate the murky interior, but slowly their sight grew accustomed to the darkness. Lining the rust-streaked walls in orderly rows were stacks of plastic storage boxes, faded numbers stenciled along the sides to identify the contents.
Those are full of MRE food packs, and those others contain ballistic vests.
I see some Hummers and an LAV in the back. And the boxes over here are full of boots, field surgery kits, radios. There's even one marked for fucking LAW rocket launchers.
Excelsior! We have hit the motherload of supplies.
This much ordnance must have been en route to a military outpost when the world ended. Perhaps even a redoubt.
Quite true, madam.
Maybe.
Looks good, but they had a 50-foot drop. How we reach it?
We can't. But once we get outside, we can come back with torches and rope. Even if there are no vills in the area, we can easily make those ourselves.
Something moved in the shadows. Ryan scowled as another droid rolled into the light. This new machine was perfect. Not a speck of rust or a scratch on the chassis. Even worse, instead of buzzsaws and hammers, this model sported a tri-barrel Gatling gun in lieu of a left arm, the enclosed Niagara-style ammunition belt going into a wide hopper attached to the back of the droid. Ryan froze as the domed head instantly swiveled upward to look directly at him, the Gatling swiveling with it. Lurching into action, Ryan threw his arms wide to push the other companions out of the way. They cleared the hole just in time. The column of hot lead hammered along the riveted ceiling, unleashing a barrage of ricochets. JB would have dropped one of his pipe bombs on the damn thing, but they were sitting over a cargo hold packed with military ordnance. One bomb could easily start a chain reaction of detonations that would remove this ship and the companions from the face of the Earth. The machine seemed to have run out of ammo.
No way.
Ryan took a spent brass from his pocket and flipped it toward the hole.
Yeah, thought so.
Pretending to be out of brass was an old trick to try to lure an enemy into sneaking a peek so that you could blow off his or her head. The droid was well programmed in military tactics. Ryan would remember that when they returned. Silently motioning the others to follow, Ryan stealthily moved away from the jagged opening until they were at the base of the ladder.
That damn machine was playing possum!
Which probably means it can't come after us. This droid didn't activate until there was an explosion. This is the reserve force. It's not going to leave that cargo bay under any circumstances.
Then we should be safe until trying to enter.
Unless there are others. Well, that's tomorrow's problem. We'll find some way to take out that droid later.
If the ship's still here.
And if those boxes aren't empty.
Paranoid.
I prefer cynic.
Seeing that the others were ready, Ryan started to climb up the ladder, holding the flare so that it stuck out to the side. As they ascended, the roots became thicker. Then the first of the leaves appeared, diamond-shaped and dark green with a thin blue stripe. Obviously a mutie, but the smell was that of ordinary kudzu. Both Ryan and JB checked the rad counters clipped to their lapels, but there was no discernible background radiation. At the next level, Ryan saw that there were no more ladders, and allowed himself a smile as a cool breeze came from the darkness to the right. Just in time, too, because the last flare died just as he emerged. Mildred pumped the handle of her flashlight and passed it to Ryan. As he advanced, the flashlight revealed that the passageway was blocked solid with plant life, the walls festooned with orchids of every color imaginable. The place resembled a rainforest more than the inside of a battleship. Drawing the panga, Ryan hacked and slashed a crude path through the foliage until finding an open hatchway. Sheathing the blade, Ryan drew the Sig Sauer and stepped over the jamb to emerge into bright sunlight. The deck was covered with a thick carpet of moss, and flowery vines hung from above. As he walked to the railing, Ryan deduced that this must be a battle station due to a large lump of rusty machine parts sitting there. It could have been a machine gun nest, or perhaps even a Vulcan mini cannon, but there was no way of telling anymore. Stretching in front of him was a large body of blue water, low waves cresting onto a wide pebble beach. Hills rose to a rocky plateau, and then abruptly jutted upward into snow-capped mountains. A thick fog moved stealthily along the lowlands, masking any signs of civilization.
That looks like the ocean. But there's no smell of salt. Could this be some sort of an inland sea?
Makes sense. Or at least a bastard big lake.
Some of them are as big as an ocean.
Christie scanned the shoreline for the remains of a dockyard, but there was nothing in sight, although there seemed to be some small islands far ahead. Now she understood why the vessel had never been looted. From stem to stern, keel to radar mast, the dense foliage completely covered the ship. She couldn't tell the size or shape of the vessel, much less where it stopped and the land began. To anybody passing, the ship would simply seem another irregular foothill. Just one lost among a dozen others.
Looks like Oregon. Good Lord, that's an aurora borealis. John, are we near the North Pole?
Could be Canada. Been there before.
Or Iceland, or even Siberia.
Nonsense. It's much too warm for either of those icy locales. However, since we have found deserts in Japan and swamps in Nevada, we could be anywhere.
Well, I can't take a reading through these clouds, but we'll find out where this is sooner or later.
Well, this is a magnificent view, though.
Head of a fall, too.
We're not going to jump, that's for damn sure. Any sign of stairs or another ladder?
But before any of them could start a search, the curtain of vegetation hanging over the exit was annihilated. Lightning fast, the companions took cover behind the pile of corroded machinery and leveled their weapons at the smoking hatchway.
By the three Kennedys, that dastardly machine did come after us.
No room to maneuver here. Gotta shut that door. Cover me.
As the companion sent a hail of lead into the hatchway, Ryan charged around the debris and crossed the balcony in under a heartbeat to throw himself flat against the vine-covered wall. Holstering his SIG, Ryan grabbed the old portal and shoved hard. Nothing happened. He tried again, with the same result, then saw that the hinges were hopelessly choked with rust and tiny vines. Shoving two fingers into his mouth, Ryan signaled the others and made a motion at the open hatchway. Nodding in understanding, JB pulled a pipe bomb out of his munitions bag and tossed it over. Making the catch, Ryan pulled out a butane lighter and started the bomb fuse burning. Knowing what to do next, the rest of the companion sent a fusillade of hot lead into the open doorway. Raising a splayed hand, Ryan silently counted down from five, and as he dropped the last finger, the others instantly stopped firing. He tossed the pipe bomb into the corridor, getting only a very brief glance inside as the explosive charge clattered along the floor to stop in the middle of the four hulking guardians jammed into the narrow corridor. The cargo droid had to have called in reinforcements. Ryan barely got behind Steele in time.
There's four of them!
Shit!
JB grimaced as he pulled out a Gren, flipped off the arming lever, pulled the pin, and whipped the bomb forward in a sideways pitch. The military sphere hit the door and bounced inside, which erupted into a searing light, and writhing tongues of chemical fire bellowed out from the hatchway, the volcanic heat wave withering the vines for yards as hundreds of leaves turned brown and fell away to expose the bare hull underneath.
Okay, the thermite will hold them for a few minutes, but that was my only grin.
Move with a purpose, people!
Going to the railing, Ryan looked down at the choppy water of the lake and tried to guess the distance. Roughly 50 feet. Unexpectedly, a sizzling beam of light stabbed through the wall alongside the roaring fire. Steadily, the power beam drew a line in the ancient metal, rising up from the deck about 12 feet, and then slowly starting to move sideways.
Sweet Jesus, the robotic sons of bitches are cutting themselves a new exit around the thermite. Follow me.
Nova jumped over the railing to hurtle toward the choppy water of the lake. Without pause, the other companions were right behind her. A cataclysm of pain engulfed the companions as they plunged into the turgid lake, the biting cold almost stealing the breath from their lungs. The agony was unbelievable. It was as if every inch of their bodies was being stabbed with tiny knives. As expected, their clothing resisted for only a few seconds, then quickly soaked through, a fresh wave of cold reaching their vulnerable skin as their weight increased tenfold. An unknown length of time passed, and incredibly, their descent began to slow, and the companions started to sluggishly rise. Fueled by a fierce determination to live, the companions forced their limbs to move, desperately swimming for the surface, the ancient scuba mantra of always follow the bubbles, keeping them going in the right direction. Erupting through the waves, the companions greedily drank in the bitterly cold air, then shivered in renewed torment as a chill invaded their aching lungs, sapping away even more of their failing strength. But that was of no real concern. They had survived. Now it was only a dozen yards or so until they were safely on shore. Swimming in steady strokes, Ryan quickly glanced around to see if everybody was present and accounted for. When a large metallic object violently smacked into the choppy water, the armed guardian promptly disappearing below the lulling waves.